all pain is psychological in a sense that we really need to be conscious to feel pain, right? So we feel pain with our brains, not with our knees or our backs.
Right. Yeah.
So in that sense, all pain is subjective and psychological. That's what we need to start with and understand that the injury model, that there is an injury there, that is not enough to explain patients' problems and patients' pain.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience here at the University of Rochester. And I want to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by one of our own very brilliant minds, Dr. Paul Jaha, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, Neuroscience, Neurology, and Dentistry here at the University of Rochester's Medical Center. Dr. Jaha's research focuses on pain, particularly how pain signals transform into pain perception in the brain, and how mechanisms are altered in chronic pain, a really difficult issue. His work explores the interaction between chronic pain and addiction, and how the brain's reward system is linked to chronic pain as well. He is currently investigating if language or facial expressions can be used to diagnose people with chronic pain, and if a biomarker in the brain can identify who is at risk of low back pain becoming chronic, and whether the brain signature of chronic low back pain can also indicate other chronic musculoskeletal conditions like knee arthritis pain or nervous system related chronic pain. Paul, it's really fantastic to have you here sitting in that seat. I'm dying to get into this issue of pain with you, which I can't imagine there's a single person listening in or watching us who hasn't had, you know, their encounters with pain and chronic pain. And it's really one of those disorders, if I might say, that impacts a huge number of people, particularly people as they age, that we don't have a whole ton of solutions for.
Thank you for having me, John. Yes, it's definitely a big, huge problem. The number, for example, in the U.S. Society is big. So almost a third of the population suffers from some kind of chronic pain. And half of these patients actually suffer from disabling chronic pain. And we're talking of the order of 50 to 60 million Americans who are suffering from disabling chronic pain. But a third, so almost 100 million, they deal with chronic pain basically.
Every day.
Yeah. Chronic low back pain, for example, is the number one cause of disability worldwide.
Right. Yeah.
So more than anything else. And like you said, as the population ages all over the globe, the prevalence of chronic pain is going to keep increasing.
You know, the average person out there develops some pain. You go to the pharmacy, the chemist, you get yourself some non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, right. The usual stuff, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and that works to a point. These are very effective, but they're effective for very small periods of time, and you can't be taking them for months and I guess forever.
Yes.
And so we're looking for more long-term solutions to the actual causes rather than just sort of treating the symptoms.
Exactly. To treat the causes, and a lot of the work now is focused on also preventing the development of chronic pain.
First of all, you put human beings into an MRI machine. We've nice examples.
Yes.
Here at the back. And you ask a very straightforward question. Is somebody suffering from chronic pain, has their brain been reorganized, changed in some way structurally based on that pain? Or the alternative is that are there risk factors in the way the brain's organized that makes you more susceptible to a chronic pain condition? Is that the two sides of the equation?
Yes, exactly. So the first question, and me and many, many other pain researchers who are working on the brain are asking this question, is how different is the brain of patients who have suffered from chronic pain? Is it different from pain-free controls? Now we are asking the question also.
Right. And the answer there is yes, right? There is very clear replicable evidence now.
Yes, now we have plenty of evidence showing that definitely it is different from a healthy population that has not at least experienced chronic pain.
And some of these, just to make sure that our listeners understand, some of these are major information highways in the brain, white matter tracks, myelinated tracks that
Yes.
have changed their density and their connectivity as a function of suffering from pain over a period of time.
Yes, so there are major structural changes. For example, we see changes in volumes and shape of some subcortical limbic areas, and also there are changes in the white matter. Although the changes in the white matter tend to be more on the measures that we see predicting what's going to happen.
I see, okay.
The cross-sectional differences between groups. But, I mean, it's
still... Which is a key insight. There are people out there who don't have necessarily pain now.
Yes.
But their brain is more susceptible in the long run to developing a chronic pain condition.
Exactly,
after an acute injury.
Yes, and we did find a white matter pathway, which is a major highway in the brain, which is connecting the frontoparietal cortices on the right. We showed that in three different sites, three different studies, different scanners, different populations, European and American patients, that this highway actually seems to have properties that can predict if you are resilient.
And is it more connectivity in that highway or less connectivity that's predictive?
So more connectivity seems to predict resilience.
Resilience.
And more directionality of water flow, as much as we can tell from the diffusion images. In addition to these findings, there are now some characteristics that we can see in the structure of patients' brains that show that they are different. And most recently, we are trying to see if we can actually identify those changes, exact changes in animal models of chronic pain, in order to be able to identify those markers in the animals and really try to understand more in depth what do they mean, how do they translate between humans and animals.
And of course, then having these objective or as close to objective markers as we can have gives you a target to shoot at in clinical trials. You actually have an outcome measure. You have a way to measure whether this functional connectivity, these structural connections are actually being impacted by the intervention, whatever it might be.
Exactly. And it has opened the door to new pathways, especially the limbic brain areas and the mesolimbic pathways. And people out there are already doing studies to try to target, for example, mesolimbic dopaminergic pathway, because from the imaging data and a lot of now animal data, it shows that it's very important in the development of chronic pain. So it gives you definitely...
So it's a really, really, really important development of a tool set.
Exactly.
That gets clinicians past smiley faces on a piece of paper.
Exactly, yes. And so new targets and also new tools. For example, I think that, I mean, it's still at its very beginning, but the pathways that we have been identifying for resilience, I think they should be tested in, for example, patients who are going for back surgery, because we know that a lot of patients with back surgery, they don't do well after the surgery, and actually some of them get worse. There is a label for that in medicine called failed back surgery syndrome. And those patients actually suffer a lot after, if they're... and this is a surgery that went completely well, no mistakes, nothing, but still the patient comes out worse
pain-wise. From a pain perspective.
Yeah.
And there's a very distinct possibility you might have been able to say something about whether this person was predisposed to this.
Exactly.
Yeah, post-surgery syndrome.
Exactly. So one way of using those markers would be, if we scan those patients' brains, will we be able to say, okay, this patient is at a higher risk of developing more pain, or is not going to respond to the surgery? And so you would avoid the suffering, and you would also avoid a lot of the cost of going through surgery also.
You know, I just want to cycle back to something that you slipped in there.
Yeah.
Multiple scanners, different manufacturers, multiple research groups across multiple countries/continents.
Yes.
That's very important, right?
Yes.
Tell us why that's important.
If you want to have a measure that is valid, it has to be reproducible across scanners, across continents, and irreproducible in the same type of population.
Right.
If you repeat it again. So that's now currently the challenge that we are facing, not just with pain imaging, but with all kinds of imaging that we are doing. And now we are working, because a lot of researchers across the world and also major funders have actually provided us with large data sets. And we are working now to see if, for example, what we have identified and others have identified in the last, I would say, 30 years of brain imaging, if it stands the test of reproducibility. Yeah. What is reproducible, what is not, and how can we validate what we have, or actually just say, well, those findings were not reproduced and we shouldn't go that way.
Yeah.
And so my lab has engaged in this effort clearly. We have two different studies where we try to really see if our finding is reproducible. But now you have also researchers who are trying to study pain in the UK Biobank, which has hundreds of thousands of brains, right?
Yeah.
Scanned. I mean, it's not a clearly well phenotyped population, but the field is heading there because we want something that is valid and reproducible and that works, that we can really bring back to the clinic and make use of it and help patients treatment.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important point, right? The rigor and reproducibility,
exactly,
that scalability across different countries is a completely key component of doing good science in this space.
Exactly.
Can we go back a little bit to the psychological behavioral health component of pain? I know from people in my own family, you know, who had, you know, suffered really, really long-term chronic pain conditions, and how hard it was for them to be taken seriously by clinicians. Because, you know, in some ways, I suppose there's a frustration for clinicians. They don't have a whole lot to offer.
Right.
And then this person keeps showing up and saying, I'm in terrible pain. I have this horrendous condition going on and on and on. And there's this component that is psychological, which is, of course, the person becomes, when you're a chronic pain sufferer, you tend to perseverate on the chronic pain, right? It becomes, in some ways, the central tenet of your daily being, right?
A
lot of people are just governed by that pain. And so it really goes into psychology, psychiatry space. How are we dealing with that? How should we be dealing with that as a clinical enterprise and a research enterprise?
I would say something that may sound a little extreme, but all pain is psychological, mm-hmm. in a sense that we really need to be conscious to feel pain, right? So we feel pain with our brains, not with our knees or our backs.
Right. Yeah.
So in that sense, all pain is subjective and psychological. And all pains have a psychological component. Now, that's what we need to start with, and in a way, understand that the injury model, that there is an injury there, that is not enough to explain patients' problems and patients' pain. So, that said, because we don't understand very well and we can't measure that experience, that psychological subjective experience, then in the medical field, we have a huge limitation. Like you said, a patient comes in repeatedly, they have pain, like patients with fibromyalgia, for example, where you can't really identify an injury, or patients with actually back pain. A lot of patients with back pain, the overwhelming majority of them, if you image the back, you don't find anything. Yeah. And actually, a lot of the imaging findings we have, we know they have almost very low yield in the sense of telling you what the patient
there's
is going
through. There's a causal injury or
exactly.
a stenosis or something.
Right, those same...
And the flip side is true too sometimes, right? You take some imaging and you see somebody who's got horrendous spinal stenosis and all kinds of calcifications, and you think this person must be in dire pain and they're completely fine. They're
exactly.
riding a bicycle every day or whatever.
Exactly, and that's a big problem, because now what can the clinician do? They can't find the injury, right, in that sense. And that's where our medical model has been for decades, maybe centuries. So, but now there is an improved understanding across disciplines that the psychological aspect of pain, that it's actually related not just to the muscles and tendons and bones, but it's also related to the nerve fibers and the spinal cord and the brainstem and the cortex, that all are, I mean, processing and receiving this input. And so now people are more aware of that, and so they tend to try to understand the patient's holistically, in the sense of, is this patient depressed? Is that patient under stress? What can we do to help them maybe improve their ability to cope with their pain, or help them reduce how much they're suffering from it before we jump at, let's say, and do a back surgery? But I would say this is still not an approach that is happening all over But the field is definitely changing. It needs more time and it needs structure. And actually, in a sense, also it needs a different way of doing business every day in the medical setting, in the sense that when a patient comes in with back pain, even like when patient, for example, comes with severe back pain to the emergency room or to a pain doctor, a clinician, they don't really think first about referring them, let's say, to see a psychologist, right? Or to talk about their life experience or how they ended up with pain. They immediately start by giving them an injection, maybe, or giving them a non-steroidal, or giving them a course of steroids. I think this will need to change if we want to really move forward with what we have learned now and what people have been saying.
So a much more holistic approach that takes psychological health in as one of the major variables. Of course, you know, when somebody's a chronic pain sufferer, the last thing they want to be told is that it's in their mind, right? That's
exactly.
Not a good message.
And exactly. And that is also, I think, related to the teaching that we had done in medical schools and the medical field and to the public, that it's in the back, it's in the knee, which is partly true, but also there is the other aspect of it that is not just in the knee or in the back, right? So there are, for example, 20% of patients who go on to have a knee replacement, but they still have pain after the knee replacement.
Yeah.
So that is key to saying that there is something beyond...
It's not just the physical...
Exactly.
Yeah, spacer. Would it be reasonable to say if somebody's had a chronic pain condition for a while, the chances that they're not depressed would be pretty close to zero? I mean, they must go hand in hand.
They interact, I would say, a lot, but you will be amazed that sometimes when I, as a psychiatrist, I see those patients a lot because patients who have gone through multiple types of treatments, the regular treatments, shots and courses of steroids and haven't responded, I see a lot of those patients myself now, not in the lab only, but in the clinic. And a lot of them are clearly depressed and they would meet a diagnosis, a DSM diagnosis of the major depressive disorder or have a PTSD or have anxiety.
Generalized anxiety disorder.
Exactly. Yeah. But there is a group of patients who do not meet those criteria. And I would say those are patients who are really frustrated because they really are in pain every day, but they want to wake up, live their life. They want to be with their
grandchildren. The motivation's high to get on with it. Yeah.
They don't have the anhedonia that comes with depression. They don't have chronic anxiety. They never had a history, I would say, of a traumatic life event that makes them mentally vulnerable. But they have a lot of chronic pain, especially also patients who have, let's say, gone through a back surgery, for example, and it didn't work, right? And so in that sense, those also are patients who they still go to work, but they suffer a lot from their back pain. And so, yes, I mean, there is a group of patients that their chance maybe of not being depressed is almost zero, like you said. But there's a patient group also that is, I would say, the frustrated group who are really upset and having a hard time coping with their pain, but they're not really depressed. They don't meet any criteria. And those patients also, it's hard to convince them, let's say, that some antidepressants have an analgesic effect.
Right.
They tell you, well, I'm not feeling depressed. Why am I being prescribed an antidepressant or a drug that works on the brain? And this is where I think education comes in. And that's what we do a lot of it.
There are lots of alternative treatments out there now. Mm-hmm. And one are the psychedelics, right?
Yes.
The psilocybin has come back. And that. Give us a little bit on that. Is there evidence for effectiveness? Is this a good space to work in?
It's definitely an area of research, I would say. I don't think that yet that we have the evidence that it works for chronic pain. There is some evidence that it works in other conditions that have things in common with pain, like major depression, for example.
Right.
But we don't yet have the evidence that it's going to be transformative also in chronic pain. I hope it will be, and I think definitely it's a field that is worth looking into. And given the fact that a lot of the chronic pain conditions like back pain is, we think, at least I'm from the group of scientists think that the brain actually plays a critical or a key role more than the periphery, I think maybe those patients could benefit from a psychedelic, for example, treatment. But I think we're still very early. We're not there yet.
And mechanism of impact on pain, do we have any idea?
It's basically hitting the reset button on the, I would say, the limbic brain, which is responsible for all kinds of emotional learning that happened during the course of our lives. And in that sense, it might actually, I would say, rewire, but in a very metaphorical way, our limbic brain to the point where it helps in giving you a new start in that sense.
And maybe breaking that ring of fire, the perseverance, the depression, anxiety, over-focus on the...
On the pain. And also there is maybe there is a gate in the brain that you might be able to close or give it... make it so that the threshold for pain to come to the conscious aspect of life is much higher now.
Very good.
With the so in a sense maybe the psychedelic will help patients rebuild some resilience to chronic pain.
That's such a good word, resilience. And so you put yourself in the camp that has a little has some hope for this as a
potential definitely.
Worth pursuing.
Yes, and I mean I don't know the data if, for example, like I'm from the also people who advocate that. I mean, there is some data in animals, animal work showing that you need some kind of hippocampal neurogenesis to form new memories, right? And that could help in...
opening up a new plastic period so that you
For the pain, exactly, for the pain to go away. And so one could think that if, for example, a big treatment like that, or I would say in a global treatment like that, would induce some kind of a neurogenesis in the hippocampus, it might actually help patients form new memories in that sense and
break a bad cycle.
Yeah, forget somehow some of the pain, right? Yeah. So
there's good research on directed forgetting. We can actually make ourselves forget things. Which is rather extraordinary notion.
Yeah.
Let's get over to you a little bit because I think, you know, it'll be evident to the listeners as it is that I'm not originally from these shores that you aren't either. So give us a little bit of the history of Paul Jiha. Yeah, I mean, you started out life in the Middle East.
Yes.
In Lebanon, right?
Yes.
So childhood in Lebanon. Tell us about that and when you got the science bug. When did you get bitten by that? And of course, the other piece here is that you're trained as a doctor, you know, a medical doctor.
As a medical doctor.
And have gone into research, which is maybe slightly atypical.
Yeah.
So give us that part.
Yeah, it's actually atypical a lot for Lebanese doctors also.
Is that right? Yeah, for cultural reasons.
Yeah, cultural reasons, yeah. So I was born and raised in Lebanon, and actually I think I was bitten by the scientific bug very early. I went to a school, it's a French school that was founded by the Lazarist priests that came to Lebanon in the 19th century. And actually... it had this, European scientific tradition that would put a lot of stress on physics and math and how important they are and how much science have changed the world. So, and in my family, my brothers actually had also that... preference, I would say, or like
your older brothers. Are they?
My older brothers, they were all, for example, good in sciences and math, and so in a sense, this was something always encouraged. And I actually, to say the truth, I loved these topics. I loved science when I was in school, and I used to enjoy studying. And also the culture in Lebanon puts a lot of emphasis, and sometimes maybe too much, on the sciences. And I discovered this a bit late, where I tried to rebalance my education towards a bit the humanities in college.
Right, yeah.
But I think a good mix of both is very important. So, but it started, I would say, very early in high school.
Yeah.
And then I went to college... in Lebanon to study biology, and then I went on to do a medical school. But I had an interruption in between where I actually decided that my humanities knowledge is limited and I really needed to delve into it. So I went and did 1 year of philosophy, just pure pure philosophy. And that actually made me think a lot about the mind and the brain. And that started really
making... So a year of philosophy is where the neuroscience piece comes in.
Exactly.
So that's, you married your biology to the process of thought.
And right. And I was also coming from a country that was just coming out of a civil war, mm-hmm. right? So when I went to college, the civil war had technically stopped in 5 years earlier. And so I had, the big question I had on my mind is how to explain what happened and how mm-hmm. can we explain human behavior and why all these bad things and atrocities that happened during the war, how can we... understand them. And right. so I first started, actually, interestingly enough, getting very interested in how can we explain violence in human beings. And my neuroscience professor in Beirut gave me the book by Konrad Lorenz on aggression. And so this is how I started really going into the topics of neuroscience. And when I studied medicine, I slowly started gravitating towards neurology / psychiatry.
Gotcha.
But then I finished my medical school.
Now let me ask you though. So is this where some cultural pressure comes in? The med school rather than going down this PhD neuroscience immediately.
That's totally correct. And I confess I cave into that pressure.
You did. Okay. Yeah. So this is mom and dad are saying you need to be a doctor.
Yes.
Yeah, you need to be a lawyer.
Exactly. And right. In a sense, in retrospect, they might have been, not totally wrong in the sense that nowadays being a PhD is riskier, even in science, mm-hmm. right? As you well know. I caved into the pressure. But I have to say that when I was doing the philosophy year, my professors in Beirut, who became my friends later on, told me also that academic philosophy is tough and...
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it would be best if you combine philosophy with science. And we actually advise you to go back also. I mean, you're great in doing philosophy. We love to have you. But if you want more security, basically, mm-hmm. in your career, I mean, it would be best maybe to go back to the sciences as well and read philosophy at the same time. Yeah. So I went back to medical school, but I didn't go to a PhD program, yes, exactly,
right.
Because I had my mind basically a bit biased or set that I should be a doctor, maybe.
Of course, I'm very understandable.
Yeah, but I confess that this was a cultural bias that I'm a victim of.
So you finish your MD. Now at some point you transitioned to the United States. Tell us, what was the decision point there? What brought you to the States and why?
After medical school, usually there is this wave that people go through always that they end up in either Europe or the US because specialty training is better. Basically.
Yeah.
So this is how it starts usually. And also...
I see. So this would be a very typical thing for a Lebanese MD graduate to do. Go to the US, go to the UK, someplace in Europe to do a subspecialty.
Exactly. And a lot of MDs go back to Lebanon to work. But that's a typical path, I would say.
Right.
And in a sense, also because I wanted something different, I wanted to travel more and really experience other cultures. And also, the situation at the time in Lebanon was not great, neither economically nor politically.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Sure,
so also leaving Lebanon to have a better life elsewhere was also a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how I ended up making the decision. And I had also, a lot of it was by accident because my neuroscience professor at the time in Beirut, he had a connection with my mentor who later became my mentor in Chicago. And so they were, they were exchanging emails and
he said, I have a good prospect for you. And
yeah. Exactly. So and I ended up in Vanya Apkarian's lab in Chicago.
Yeah.
It was a bit by accident. I didn't have much choice at the time.
Yeah.
But I thought I saw he was doing brain imaging and I was immediately very excited.
And Vanya is a pain researcher. Is that the intro to pain specifically then?
Exactly. This is how I started in pain research, because Vanya is still a world renowned researcher in pain. And also there is a tradition in at the American University of Beirut, actually, a lot of the neuroscience department included faculty who were doing pain research, but in Beirut they were doing it on animal models.
I see.
And so there is this tradition and link.
Okay.
This is how also I ended up in the pain field.
Now you went to Chicago, but you ended up at Yale. So tell us about that transition and what brought you to Yale.
Yeah, so I did actually 5 years in Vanya's lab and doing research and brain imaging in pain patients, and it was actually quite exciting. And I had a hard time deciding actually whether I should go back to the clinic or not. And of course, my mom always was reminding me that I should be a real doctor. And by the end, I think
that's what mothers are there for, you know.
Yeah. By the end of the 4 or 5 years, I got convinced that I can go to psychiatry and bring some ideas from what I've learned in the lab back to psychiatry, where we can do more measurement of the subjective experience not just pain at the time, but I ended up going back to pain research. But I had the idea in mind that this is psychiatry would be the place where, if you've had an experience in brain imaging, it would be great to be, because you can bring the tool that now everybody is using. So I applied for the match, and I ended up in that matching at Yale University.
And then we got you. We poached you in the end here at Rochester, and we're very pleased to have you here. These are turbulent times for science.
Yes.
And we're in a transition patch, you'd have to say. Youngsters coming into the field, students coming to your lab. What are you saying to them? How are you saying to them, this is a good idea, or can you say that in good conscience to be in our field?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, this is a very turbulent time and very concerning time. I think students who come to the lab these days are actually quite aware of how difficult it is to be in science. And I just tend to remind them, and a lot of them already know this, like, for example, what I think my mentors used to tell me, like Vanya, for example, that if you don't feel really passionate about science, you might not be ready for the sacrifices that you have to do. Because we work a lot, we tend not to have a lot of vacations or a lot of free time.
Right.
And in a sense, it's work that you can never really stop doing. You always bring it. If you bring your laptop home, or if you have any access to the internet, then you can work, right? And it's not something you can stop doing. And for me, I don't look at it really as work. I enjoy doing
it. It's a vocation.
Exactly. And I feel very lucky, actually, still very lucky, despite those turbulent times. But I tell my students that they have to know what they're getting into. And also, the good thing is that sometimes you have postdocs or students that come to the lab that actually just are going to do 1 or 2 years and then decide whether they're going to stay or not. And so, in a sense, there is still this opportunity where people can decide whether they're going to go into it, like physicians, for example, like me, whether they're going to stay in science or go back. But of course, nowadays, I would say the risk of them, or the probability of them not staying, is much higher than it used to be. Yeah.
And as you say, that it's much less risky when you have that MD in your back pocket, because you can always...
Exactly.
That's your safety net. You can go back to doctoring, being a real doctor, as your mother had said.
It paid off in the end, during those times. But in a sense, also, that's not... In a sense, that's unfortunate, right? So I didn't want it to be this way. And I feel that PhDs should have that security as right? And should feel that they can do this and take the risk. Because, you know, in science, there is a lot, there are lots of unknowns. And even if you are doing the right thing and asking the right questions, you might not get the answers you want or you think you're going to have. And so there are lots of failures.
Yeah.
And lots of negative results, I would say.
Yeah.
And that is happening every day. And if that's happening...
And it's interesting, you say failures, and I appreciate why you say that. But in our lab, we say there's really not a failure. Yes, it might not work out the way you had thought it would, but that's an information, that's a piece of very, very valuable information. It shuts that particular thesis down, and then you move to the next one. And by definition, 95% of the things that we do shouldn't work, right?
Exactly. Maybe failure is a strong word, but yes, exactly. And also this atmosphere of funding that is really hard, like where, for example, NIH's funding line keeps getting lower and lower, right? And so that means a lot of the grants you're going to send are not going to get funded despite having really relatively good scores, right? So all of this now factors in, and this is something, I don't know, I think every scientist now at any level thinks about every day. And so that's what
There's definitely anxiety in the communities, right? But would you consider yourself hopeful, or are you a little bit pessimistic about the next decade, let's say?
I am hopeful because I still think, and maybe I'm being a bit romantic here, that science is the only, I would say, I call it thing or activity that will always change the world. And I still think that there are scientists out there, I hope I'm one of them, but that are going to actually change the way we think and change the world and move the fields that they are working in forward to the point where science is again seen again as something that...
Properly valued,
exactly. And that this is something we cannot exist without investing in it. Mm-hmm. And so I still feel that there are scientists who are doing that already, and that's going to keep happening. And in that sense, I think people who undervalue science maybe will get to realize that they're making a mistake, a huge mistake.
Right.
So in that sense, I am optimistic. But if you ask me the path to optimism I have, it's not very clear. But I'm not going to give up.
Well, that's a great hopeful message to finish on, I think. And I, you know, as you just said, I hope I'm one of them. I've had the great good fortune to observe the work that you've been doing over the past few years, and I'm absolutely certain that you're making major contributions to the world of neuroscience. I know that for a fact, Paul. Paul, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for also having me, and I'm also feel very lucky to be at the Neuroscience Institute here.
Excellent.
Thanks.